This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. It's a journey that requires collaboration, curiosity, and communication among farmers, researchers, agronomists, consultants, and extension. You're going to hear their stories and discover how and why they're working together to make sense out of what's happening in the soil. Hey, thanks so much for joining me for this episode of Soil Sense. I'm your host, Tim Hamrich. We have a really fascinating episode for you here today about incorporating perennials into crop rotations. I don't think we've specifically done an episode on this podcast before dedicated exclusively to this topic, but we definitely have talked about the benefits. Things like keeping living roots in the soil year-round, diversifying rotations, and minimizing soil disturbance. Perennials are great options for all of the above. Joining us is Dr. Claire Keene, Extension Specialist in Cropping Systems at NDSU, based out of the Williston Research Extension Center in Northwest North Dakota. Claire and I talk about how she's working with farmers to incorporate perennials for a variety of reasons, including managing salts and reclaiming topsoil after pipeline construction up there. We also talk about the profitability of these perennial crops relative to growing annual row crops, and we discuss a promising new crop called Kernza. First and foremost, many farmers who want to include perennials into their crop rotations for soil health reasons might be concerned by the decrease in yield and revenue that they're going to see versus annual crops. But Claire says it's important to also consider the other side of the equation, the reduced costs associated with these crops.
The primary use for perennial grass or something like alfalfa, perennial forb, would be as forages or hay. And so you can graze or hay many of these species, and that certainly has the economic benefit of being able to sell that product. What some people maybe don't factor in is they think about, you know, maybe how much money they're not getting in bushels of grain off those acres. But that's also how many dollars and inputs you're not spending. You're not paying for new seed each year. You're probably not going to be fertilizing it each year. Many stands of perennials, once they get going, they don't even need weed control, so you're not spraying. And then if you're in a tillage situation and you'd be doing tillage-based weed control, then obviously you don't need to do that in a perennial either. So once those perennials are well established, they're really taking care of themselves. And so your input costs then become, you know, mowing it one, two, or three times per year, depending on what that growth is like. And then, you know, the cost associated with baling up those forages. And relative to the cost of seed, fertilizer, pesticides that traditionally we're doing on our annual crop acres, forages are much more profitable because you have fewer inputs over time. So yes, there's that initial investment, of course, in the seed. And yes, the alfalfa and some of those perennial grass seeds can be a little pricey. But if you think about the fact that you're spreading that cost out over 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe even 7 years, if that stand stays nice and thick, you've reduced your per year input costs dramatically compared to, saying, wheat that you'd be fertilizing pretty heavily each year.
Claire says if we can make these perennials profitable in a rotation, we could start to realize some of these soil health benefits, like year-round living roots that improve soil biological activity and water infiltration, less disturbance and less chemical use, improve soil structure, and more. In Claire's area of North Dakota, she's also using perennials to revitalize soil from things like salt accumulation and even pipeline construction.
Out here in western North Dakota, the Bakken oil boom started a little over 10 years ago now, and it is continuing. It's slowed down a little bit, but we're actually now in a phase where companies are putting in lots and lots of gathering lines. So rather than trucking oil away from all these well pads, they're putting in gas lines, they're putting in oil lines, there are even freshwater and produced water lines going in. And there's just pipelines going in everywhere. We have lots of them that have gone in and many more are planned. And most of them are put in by trenching. So if a pipeline needs to go through, the standard operating procedure for that is you scrape off the topsoil and put it in a pile. You excavate the subsoil and you put it in a separate pile. You put in your pipeline. Maybe you put in some gravel or other substrate with it, and then you replace the subsoil compact it to make sure it stays where it needs to be, and then you put the topsoil back over it. And that is obviously a tremendous amount of disturbance to the soil. You lose your soil horizons, those natural layers of the soil that have developed over a geologic time scale. And the consequences that has for plant growth can be potentially quite detrimental, because if you have mixing of that subsoil with the topsoil, you can then end up with either a high salt topsoil, that salinity issue, or very high pH, which can also negatively impact plant growth. Certainly bringing rocks to the surface can be an issue, you know, for managing with our planters and combines. And then also you lose a lot of organic matter from that soil while it's sitting in a pile. You potentially just lose a lot of that soil if those piles aren't properly protected. You know, we get a windstorm and it blows away. We get heavy rains and it washes, and you just don't have as much soil as you started with to put back. So the process of what's called reclamation, or reclaiming these pipelines, ideally in a perfect world, you'd dig it out, you'd put in the pipeline, you'd put it back, and you could just go back to growing 40 bushel per acre wheat. But the reality of that happening is it's just not the case. I mean, I think we get lucky. I mean, sometimes good management practices of those pipeline installations can help promote good crop growth afterwards. But in many situations, because of compaction, because of topsoil mixing, just because of disturbing that soil structure, we lose a lot of that soil's capacity to grow a good annual crop. And so I've been working with a farmer who was struggling for a number of seasons to grow an annual crop on a pipeline that was installed along the length of a section that he owns. And he was figuring that he was losing probably in the neighborhood of $200 an acre on about 30 acres, because it was, you know, it's 300 feet wide by a mile long. So that area that he was attempting to farm in the same way he did his undisturbed soil, he wasn't getting anything back from those input costs, the seed, the fertilizer, the herbicide sprays. And so he did try a cover crop, but the cover crop wasn't very good at breaking up the level of compaction that he had. And so we had a conversation about it, and I said, would you be open to trying perennials? And so we seeded a couple different alfalfa and grass mixes in some large demonstration plots along that mile-long pipeline, and we got very good establishment of the grass and the alfalfa, and he's partnered with a neighbor who does have cattle, who's able to come and hay it, and then they split those bales. And so his initial costs were the seed, and then our soil conservation district offers custom seeding at a pretty affordable rate. So for very minimal input cost the first year, he's now had, I guess, at least three seasons of being able to get forage harvest off of it, again, with only that initial input cost of seeding and the seed in the first year. We haven't done any additional fertility or weed control. And so for, you know, having those initial input costs spread out over 3 years now, and then the return of the forage, he's come out ahead on those acres, even above many of his annual crops the last couple of years.
Claire says this farmer's long-term goal is to bring the soil back to the point that he can reintroduce annual crops. They've already noticed the compaction improving, but she says they're probably still at least a couple of years from reaching that point. She's also working a lot with farmers who are trying to manage salinity issues with perennials.
If it's not at a point that inhibits annual growth, you can do things like annual cover crops or grow some of our more salt-tolerant annual crops. So barley is usually where a lot of people start doing a cover crop. So if you're going to keep annual cropping, get in a cover crop in the fall to continue to use that moisture as long as it can into the fall, and then early in the spring that can help. Doing some deeper rooted annual crops like sunflower that really do draw a lot of water out while they're growing and access water pretty deep in the soil profile, that helps. But again, even a sunflower being a longer season crop, you know, it's only using water, say, May through September. And, you know, what about October through April? Again, that's where the advantage of a perennial is there, because they'll start growing when they wake up in the spring, maybe March or April, depending on the year, and then keep going October, November, whenever it is that we get cold. So they're just doing a better job of using water more efficiently throughout the year. But so your question, you know, what kind of salt-tolerant options do we have? It depends on how salty your soil is. You can definitely manage it around where the salts are the worst. So if it's too salty, say in that 1 or 2 acres where it's white on the surface to get anything to grow, planting the area around it to something like alfalfa is a great way to manage it, because you're using up that water before it's sitting under that seep and bringing more salts to the surface. There are some salt-tolerant alfalfa varieties, and I'm currently working with those. And so those are able to grow at maybe an EC 5, 6, 7, maybe a little bit higher, and can get some of that alfalfa to establish a little bit further into those salty areas. But it's certainly the case that we have areas where even a salt-tolerant alfalfa won't grow. And so then we're really looking at our salt-tolerant grasses. And so those can be native species like a western wheatgrass. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I don't have my list in front of me. There are some native species that fit that bill, but then also some improved forage species. There's some hybrid wheatgrasses. A variety called AC Saltlander is very good. A newer one called New High. Tall wheatgrass, green wheatgrass, many of those species can tolerate just a much higher level of salt as they're establishing. And so planting a really salty area to those perennial grass species is typically what's needed if it's really salty. But again, managing the water table around where you see the problem at the surface is the most effective way to deal with it, because that water management issue tends to be where that water, you know, is collecting from the landscape and just happens to be shallow enough to get pulled to the surface. The water evaporates, the salt accumulates. But the most effective way to manage that, again, 1 or 2 acre salty bare spot is to plant a larger area of perennials around it.
Now, of course, in an ideal world, we'd get the revenue and productivity of annual grain or legume crops with the reduced costs and soil health benefits of these perennial crops. And we're not there yet, but there is progress being made. The Land Institute has been breeding a new crop called Kernza, which is a perennial grain that they're developing from intermediate wheatgrass.
So for about the last 4 years now, I've been involved with a group researching Kernza. And so what Kernza is, it's intermediate wheatgrass, which is a cool season forage species that's been around for decades. But what makes Kernza Kernza is that there's a breeder at the Land Institute in Kansas who's been selecting intermediate wheatgrass lines for increased seed size and yield for over 15 years now. And there's also a breeder at the University of Minnesota who started to work on this. And so we're now at a point where we have these intermediate wheatgrass lines that are producing, I think, in the neighborhood of 3 to 5 times more seed than the old forage types of intermediate wheatgrass. And the Land Institute has trademarked the name Kernza, and so they hold the trademark on these improved, call them more small grain-like intermediate wheatgrass lines, where they have improved seed size and yield. To tell you about Kernza, so it's intermediate wheatgrass that's been bred for grain characteristics, and it can be harvested usually in its second year, because it does need to vernalize like winter wheat. So if you plant it in the fall, it'll survive over the winter, and then you'd be harvesting it late next summer. If you spring plant it, it'll establish and grow through the summer, but it won't produce a head. It won't produce a head until after it's gone through the winter. So in terms of stand longevity, it's such a new crop. We don't have a definitive answer for that yet. It does seem to be able to produce grain for 3 years, and in drier environments, we do think a bit longer, maybe 4 or 5 years. In 2021, I'll harvest the third year of a variety trial that I've had in the ground since 2018. But can it keep going longer than that? It might. But then the question becomes, you know, if seed production declines over time, at what point is it no longer economical to harvest the grain and you're better off just going back into an annual crop? We're not quite sure yet. But again, thinking about spreading out your input costs over time, a small grain crop that you could get 3 or 4 years of harvest off of and not have to do tillage or fertilization really represents a potentially very big cost savings.
Now, this concept is still very much in development, and even though they've come a long way, the yields aren't close yet to what you'd see in a wheat crop, for example.
So Minnesota and Wisconsin, farmers that have been growing it there for a few years are getting somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 to 900 pounds per acre. So compare that to wheat, you know, let's see, what would it be? A 40 bushel wheat crop would be 2,400 pounds of grain per acre. So we're still at a fraction of what a good spring wheat crop would be. But in terms of intermediate wheatgrass, compared to those old forage varieties that are maybe somewhere in the 100 to 200 pounds of seed per acre neighborhood, you know, that progress in breeding is really becoming evident. So in a wetter environment, kind of the 500 to 900 pound range, I think they did have a farmer hit 1,000 pounds per acre in 2020, which they're very excited about. Out here in western North Dakota, my small plots are in the 300 to 400 pounds per acre range. And I think that, you know, that just reflects the difference in moisture. You know, in Williston, we're lucky to get 14 inches of precip per year, whereas in, you know, Minnesota, they're regularly getting 25, 30 inches.
But despite these improvements that still need to be made in yield, there's a lot of potential here for benefits that go beyond grazing and forage.
I'm excited about it because of the potential flexibility it offers. So, you know, having this, at least right now, niche, you know, small grain, high value product off those acres, but then also it does get fairly tall. So 3 to 4 feet tall out in western North Dakota, it can get taller in Minnesota and Wisconsin. That residue does need to be taken off the field to stimulate head production the next year. So if you can use that as livestock bedding, so straw can be a valuable co-product, if you want to call it that, off those acres as well. In a wetter environment, so in Wisconsin, they've been able to do a spring grazing on it and then harvest it for grain and not lose grain yield by doing it. So getting both an animal feed value out of it as well as the grain. I think in a drier environment, we would struggle to do that. I haven't done that research yet, but I would just anticipate we don't tend to get enough water, I think, for those stands to really recover before producing seed. But we'll see. Hopefully, I'll be able to do that.
Because Kernza has been specifically developed for its soil health benefits, there's already a small but strong and growing niche market that wants to buy the grain.
So yes, there is a lot of interest in Kernza grain. If you're a consumer out there looking for it, if you're on the West Coast, there is a beer being distributed by Patagonia Provisions called Longroot Ale that's been around for 3 or 4 years now that's being brewed with Kernza. So that's one product you might run into. 2 years ago now, General Mills did a limited release of a Kernza-containing cereal that they actually sold as a... Well, it ended up being kind of a fundraiser that they didn't quite have enough Kernza to do as big a release as they had hoped. And so they did it as a limited release, and a portion, I can't remember what it was, but a percent of the dollars of each box of cereal went back to support the breeding program at the Land Institute. So that's been out there. There's a few microbreweries in the Minneapolis-St. Paul and Madison, Wisconsin areas that you can buy Kernza beer and some Kernza hard spirits. And then there's a small group in, I think, central Minnesota called Perennial Pantry that's selling Kernza grain and flour. So if you want to bake Kernza bread, you can purchase it from them. But so the situation currently just on the marketing side is that it's very small. So it's very small, it's direct marketing, it's working with those end users for them to purchase your product off farm, because we don't currently have any elevators accepting Kernza yet.
And this is also hitting on another major theme that everyone, it seems like, has been talking about lately: improved carbon sequestration and other ecological services.
Many food companies have come out with carbon goals, and so they either want something like a carbon neutral supply chain by 2030 or 2050, or, you know, they're internally trying to think about ways to show consumers that they're supporting soil health and that their products, you know, have some environmentally friendly benefits to them, both, again, because of their corporate sustainability goals, but also as a way to show to their consumers who care about that issues that they're actively, you know, engaged in trying to take steps in that direction. And so Kernza does fit into food companies' goals of carbon neutrality. Those Kernza plants have very deep roots, 10 plus feet when they're established, and they are sequestering a lot of carbon in the soil. The group down at the Land Institute in Kansas has some agroecologists working with it who've been monitoring soil carbon sequestration under Kernza stands and have been seeing some very good results with that. So we're still building the body of research data on what exactly Kernza's doing and its potential for carbon sequestration. But there's also quite a lot of interest, say, in the state of Minnesota, looking at Kernza as something that can fit into like their buffer rule. So planting perennials along stream buffers for water quality and helping to keep nutrients out of water sources. The state of Minnesota, through, I believe it's called Forever Green, an institute affiliated with the University of Minnesota, they've been working with Kernza for a number of years now to monitor changes in water quality where Kernza fields get planted, and specifically how it can help keep nitrates out of drinking water sources. So I guess that's not the end user companies, but that's a state saying we see a fit for this crop in some of our areas where we have shallow aquifers that are used for human drinking water. And there's a tension between, you know, this very valuable farmland where farmers want to grow corn, soybean, sugar beet, but yet the imperative to keep agricultural fertilizers out of drinking water is also very high. And so if you have a perennial that can also be a cash grain harvest option, that can really have the potential to be a win-win for a farmer who's, you know, who doesn't have livestock, who's not interested in becoming a forage producer, giving them a cash grain option that can also do the work of protecting the drinking water sources that, that happen to be in that area.
Now, you may or may not be ready to give Kernza a try on your operation, but that's okay. The principles here of building soil health while lowering input costs and still generating revenue applies to other perennial crops beyond just Kernza.
To take it back to the economics for the farmer, those reduced input costs are also a big benefit of a perennial. Because again, if you think about what the life of a Kernza stand would be, yes, you're paying for that seed, the time and the fuel to plant it, but then if it gets established, you now have 3-4 years where you don't have the seed input cost. For fertility right now, only something about 50 pounds per acre of nitrogen is needed or recommended for grain production. So that's half or a third of what you might be putting on a wheat or corn crop. You know, and then again, that potential added benefit of straw removal, having bedding material in addition to a grain harvest for multiple years. And again, saving all that time and cost of needing to prepare the soil or plant again, and just saving the costs associated with that. Think about how much money, how many inputs it takes to produce that cash grain every year. Again, it's the cost of the seed, the fertilizer, the pesticides, the planting, if you do any tillage, the time and fuel of that. And when you put in a perennial, you're giving yourself a break from those input costs. I mean, granted, you have to figure out a way, if it's going to be harvested for forage, to make that work. Not every grain farmer has a swather and a baler, but hopefully they have a neighbor who does and would be willing to come to some kind of agreement to have some income off those acres. But I think the power of perennials, you know, people maybe get turned off from the idea of a perennial by those initial input costs. I'd say typically because the seed cost can be rather expensive per pound, especially for some of the native grass species. But when you think about the longer term return potential, then they usually tend to pencil out better than annual crops, because you just, yes, you have that upfront investment to get them established, but if they keep going for 3, 4, 5, 6 years, you've spread out that cost over that time frame. And then, of course, you can have the benefit if you're in a county with a soil conservation district that offers any kind of cost share, or working with, say, an NRCS office to find out if there's any conservation programs that you'd be eligible for with your planting. That can really help offset the establishment costs as well and make it even more economical.
Thank you so much to Dr. Claire Keene for sharing the power of perennials on today's episode. If you'd like to learn more about Kernza specifically, you can go check out the website kernza.org for more information there. Thanks as well to the sponsors of Soil Sense, the North Dakota Corn Council, the North Dakota Wheat Commission, the North Harvest Dry Bean Association, the North Dakota Barley Council, and Anheuser-Busch. If you're getting value from these podcasts, please leave us a rating and review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and share your favorite episode on Twitter using the hashtag SoilSense. We'll be back with another great episode next week.